Daddy, a man on the radio said there might be a war. He's saying how we should unplug all our radio and TV and stuff. There's not going to be a war, is there?
Sir, we need access to the keys and the authentication documents at this time.
Okay, do you have your key here?
Yes, sir.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Big Brother Britain, where whistleblowers and journalists who tell hard truths end up behind bars. Well, we've already seen it with Edward Snowden, but why is the establishment so concerned? We might find out what they're up to. The Guardian warned last week that even beyond the Snoopers Charter, which is now law, Theresa May's still not happy. She's pursuing a new and unprecedented attack to criminalise journalists and whistleblowers. It's taking Britain down a path to a police state. How do you protect yourself from an NSA cyber attack, whether or not it's blamed on Russian President Vladimir Putin personally? My acronym is PREFABS. Passwords, real privacy, email, firewalls, air gaps, backups and software. We'll do our best to run through these two latest bricks in Big Brother's war for you tonight with land rights and privacy journalist Kevin Cahill. Also, the threat poised by the cashless society, which nobody has really asked for. Apart from the banksters. And Russian-born philosopher, author and filmmaker Andrei Vilcek's got a new novel out based around an Indonesian painter called Aurora. It's an attempt to show the David and Goliath struggle here in the West against cultural vandalism, the acres and days of safe, bland art now being commissioned and promoted right across the West. Plus, author of The Shadow of the Crescent and historian and Islamic architecture, Jakub Zaki, was in Bristol the other week, and as I was walking him back from the bus station, he started to talk about another passion of his, revolution, politics and secret societies, the Templars, the Masons and the Triads. In some ways, it was more interesting than the interview I did with him in the Lord Mayor's Chapel, so I whipped out my voice recorder just before he caught the coach back to London. And this is the last politics show from me until April. I'm off to New Zealand during March, and my well-worn, but hopefully not too smelly shoes are being admirably filled by Steve Satan and Billy Quain over the next 5 weeks. And inshallah, on my return, we have one amazing guest who's proved the original Jewish entitlement to millions of dollars worth of their wealth stolen by the Nazis. He is UBS security guard Christoph Molpin, and he's saved a treasure trove of documents from his boss's shredder. Also, Mayor Marvin Rees is lined up for May's Metro Mayor election show. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, Andrei Vilcek explains in full why the West is doomed culturally, militarily and economically. And I give a précis of a talk I was asked to do at the end of last year on eschatology in the 21st century in a former London synagogue. Also, Dialect throughout the rest of March, we have four special shows. We meet Silver Sound in a way. David Lowe, who was sacked by the BBC 4 years ago. He was a regional broadcaster and he used to do a programme on Sunday evenings. And that programme, fantastic, is Singers, Swingers and Singers, I believe it's called. And he's got done four specials for us, which will be being broadcast on Tuesdays at noon throughout March, after next Tuesday's show. That's Dialect on noon every Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect or download it from dialectradio.co.uk. UK. And a very special thanks for David to David Lowe for doing those shows for us. But first, we're joined by the journalist Kevin Carhill. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
I tried to bring you on that story at the end of the second, the end of the first hour there. But I want to ask you again what you make of this these accusations against Ted Heath, because it's really quite important, and it's an era I think which you're going to be more familiar with than Martin and I. But it was quite a sensational headline in the Mail on Sunday, and it doesn't really seem to have been picked up very much by the rest of the London media since.
Yeah, it's when I first saw the recent allegations, I thought, I've seen those before. So I sent the public record of the allegations against Heath to the Wiltshire Police. Now, the thing about these public allegations was they were traced to an undercover operator in Northern Ireland called Colin Wallace. Now, this isn't exonerating Heath or anything, but there is a trace in the public record, in the parliamentary record, of this guy smearing Heath and having been put up to it by the security services, MI5. So the Wiltshire Police did acknowledge my submission, and they came back to me and asked me what I knew personally. Well, the problem was my personal knowledge was public. So I told them that I'd given him the record, and that's where they should start, you know, with this, with the actual proven smear against Heath. I was on the diplomatic circuit for a bit, and I used to meet Heath. But you can tell nothing. When you meet somebody in a reception, what can you tell? You can't tell anything. But they could have cleared one element of the allegations, or at least pinned them down to MI5. Because it's a matter of public record. It's on the parliamentary record, Hansard, and lots of other places.
Well, why would the security services be wanting to smear somebody like that?
They objected to whatever it was he was up to in Northern Ireland. It was relatively simple. They wanted to stop whatever Heath was doing.
Okay, so, I mean, my involvement with this, I suppose, I mean, it's on the public record, but I was working in Salisbury, where Ted Heath lived in the early 1990s for the BBC, and it was a kind of weird setup that there was there, because he lived in a house on the Cathedral Close, just by the cathedral, and I remember going past there, and you'd see this guy kind of with a gun behind one of the conifers in the front garden with a automatic weapon ready to sort of shoot anybody that, because of course there was the legacy from Northern Ireland. Heath had been very much involved as Prime Minister when the Troubles were going on and at their height in Northern Ireland, and there's been a lot of discussion about that this week. But the important thing to relate here is that another freelancer and I were convinced that there was a quite systematic sexual abuse going on within child sexual abuse going on within Salisbury at two children's homes, which were both owned by or managed by the vice chair of the local Conservative group on Salisbury District Council, and we tried to get those allegations out to the public, and that is the point at which I was sacked from the well, I wasn't sacked because I was freelancing, but I was just told we don't require your services anymore as soon as I started raising this as a potential news story. So it did seem to me when all this stuff about VI paedophilia came out that there is actually a lot more to this than meets the eye, having seen, you know, having no absolute evidence to say that was why I lost my job, but you know, putting two and two together, and it wasn't just me, we were discussing this with other journalists in Salisbury, at the Salisbury Journal, etc., and we were putting evidence together to get the stuff out to the public. But anyhow, there's been a lot of talk this week also about Northern Ireland and British crimes in Northern Ireland particularly, and it came up twice, in fact. I'll get both of your comments on this at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
I think it's absolutely appalling when people try to make a business out of dragging our brave troops through the courts. In the case of Northern Ireland, 90% of deaths were caused by terrorists, and it's essential that the justice system reflects this. It would be entirely wrong to treat terrorists more favourably than soldiers or police officers. And that's why, as part of our work to bring forward the Stormont House Agreement Bill, we will ensure that investigative bodies are under a legal duty to be fair, balanced and proportionate. so that our veterans are not unfairly treated or disproportionately investigated.
Julian Lewis, while welcoming that reply, it doesn't go quite as far as I and many other people would like. There is no prospect of new credible evidence coming forward against our veterans of the Troubles up to 40 years after the event, yet people are starting to use the same techniques in Northern Ireland against them as were used against veterans of Iraq. Surely the answer has to be a statute of limitations preventing the prosecution of veterans to do with matters that concerned prior to the date of the Belfast Agreement.
Prime Minister.
Well, as my honourable friend knows, this is an issue that we're looking at as part of the Stormont House Agreement. What we're doing is ensuring that the investigative bodies responsible for looking at deaths during the Troubles will operate in a fair, balanced and proportionate manner. We want cases to be considered in chronological order, and we want these protections enshrined in legislation. We're going to be consulting fully on these proposals because we want to make sure that we do get this right.
Martin, she's saying there, the Prime Minister, she's saying effectively that there can be, in fact, the MP Julian Lewis is also saying that it's very unlikely that there's going to be any new evidence come out, so maybe there should not be any prosecutions of any British Army officers involved in actually stoking the Troubles themselves.
Well, I mean, when she says 90% of the deaths were caused by terrorists, you could say 100% of the deaths were caused by terrorists. The allegation, the substance of the allegations, as made in the Panorama documentary of last year by Donald McIntyre, is that the British Army was systematically aiding and abetting the loyalist paramilitaries in their campaign of violence, and also that they'd infiltrated the IRA to such an extent that they were actually responsible for some of the IRA's atrocities as well. Now, I understand why people say we don't want to go back over this, in a sense that what the peace deal says is this is the end of it. But it's not the end of it if people haven't come forward. We haven't had a peace and reconciliation deal where people just come forward and say what they're involved with. But Brigadier Gordon Kerr was fingered by Sir John Stevens, head of the Metropolitan Police at the time, as a terrorist for orchestrating the Loyalist paramilitary terror campaign, which killed hundreds of people. He's not been prosecuted. Most of the other terrorists, whether loyalist or Republican, have served their time and been released under agreement. I'm afraid that the senior officers in the British Army and intelligence services who are also implicated have not been prosecuted, and that can't be right. That's why the Police Service of Northern Ireland was set up, independent of the intelligence services, independent of the British government, and they've got a duty as a police service to carry on investigating unsolved crimes.
Well, bizarrely this week, if you were listening to Prime Minister's Questions on 5 Live, you wouldn't have heard that question, because it was blotted out by another news report in the middle of Prime Minister's Questions. It was blotted out. There was some other news report came in. And so you wouldn't have heard that. And also, there was a second question about this issue, which was put, and we'll hear from Kevin after this, by Sir Julian Brazier.
Sir Julian Brazier.
Mr. Speaker, my right honourable friend gave a sympathetic answer to our honourable friend for the New Forest. And I know she's taken a particular interest in this matter. But could I put it to her that for many of us, there is something profoundly wrong with a criminal justice system which can pursue veterans who risk their lives for this country 40 years on, long after any possibility of new evidence, while at the same time is capable of paying out £1 million to a terror suspect?
Prime Minister.
To my honourable friend, in relation to this issue in Northern Ireland, we are, of course, that the issue of these legacy bodies was a part of the Stormont House Agreement, and what we are doing is working to deliver on that Stormont House Agreement. As I said in answer to my honourable friend, the member for New Forest East, the overwhelming majority of our armed forces serving in Northern Ireland served with great distinction, and we owe them a huge debt of gratitude. The situation we have at the moment is that there are cases being pursued against officers who served in Northern Ireland. What we want to see as we develop the legacy body under the Stormont House Agreement is a proportionate, fair and balanced approach to that. As I said earlier, we recognise that the majority of individuals who suffered were actually the result at the hands of terrorists.
Yeah, she seems to be sort of stumbling over her words then, reading stuff out, Kevin. But anyway, what do you make of this? I mean, Martin's brought up this issue of there was no proper Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So there's still the possibility there may be prosecutions on either side after the end of the Troubles.
Well, there's the Bloody Sunday issue, where Lord Saville, Lord Justice of Appeal, said the killings were murder. And that has to be addressed. Now, I have an odd perspective here, because I was one of those troops in Northern Ireland at one time, long ago. And I never got involved in these kind of incidents, but they have cropped up in a context I understand. But if you follow the court cases cropping up in Northern Ireland, we're back to what Martin said again and again. The people committing murders on both sides appear to have been on the payroll of either the security services or the army or some part of the British government. I mean, and this is really, he's named a name.
In charge at the time, quite a lot of it was Ted Heath. There were others, obviously, Margaret Thatcher. But the Defence Secretary, Lord Carrington, these people don't really seem to ever be cautioned, questioned or anything about the involvement, because, you know, people will look at that conflict and say it possibly couldn't have happened without the British state provoking things in some ways.
Well, you know, as a soldier on the ground, the war changed in 1972, you know, and I could feel the change because I understood the system. Some other force started guiding what was going on, the killings, you know, rose very sharply, and the assassinations and everything. And there is Anne Cadwallader's book, where there was a fellow called Jackson running around in mid-Ulster, and he murdered between 50 and 100 people. And he was intimately associated with the RUC. And, you know, there were some assassinations.
Those are the police. They were the police at the time, weren't they?
Yeah, they were the police. But some of the evidence was extraordinary. You know, people in long coats, you know, machine gunning somebody. And how did you know they sort of traced that to the police? They were all wearing police boots underneath their long coats and were seen. It's a very, very murky situation.
So, but anyway, I mean, 40 years on, surely there can't be any new evidence. This is what Julian Brazier is saying, that they shouldn't be pursuing people now.
Well, the problem is there are the relatives of those who were murdered who deserve justice. And it's, you know, the situation there is unresolvable because a great deal of the evidence has been hidden by part of the state. We'll never get at it.
You think no, never, Martin?
What?
I think the idea that something 40 years ago can't be investigated is simply wrong. I mean, the evidence will still be there somewhere. As Theresa May rightly said, these investigations are part of the Stormont Agreement.
Yeah.
Now, what Sinn Féin and others have been calling for many years is let's have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where everybody comes forward and says, actually, I was doing this, I was doing that. Because what most people don't seem to realise is that there was more than one side involved in this. The British state was definitely deeply involved with the loyalist paramilitaries. That's what the Panorama programme of Donal McIntyre of last year showed. And, of course, they were also heavily infiltrating the IRA, including the IRA's internal intelligence operation.
Yep.
I don't think they were entirely in charge of the IRA, otherwise there wouldn't have been two assassination attempts on Tory prime ministers. But there's a lot more there than meets the eye. And James Brokenshire, who's the Northern Ireland secretary, is saying, we don't want the police rewriting history. Well, I would say that we haven't actually had the proper history yet, and the Police Service of Northern Ireland was set up after the RUC was disbanded on the understanding that they would be independent of the British government and that they would pursue things independently. And I think if they've got evidence against elements of the British state, then they should carry on looking into what they know.
I know people like David Southwell has raised with me the possibility of what was really going on with things like the murder of or the assassination of Lord Louis Mountbatten, because there were very big reasons, as we've now seen, that the British establishment might have wanted him dead, since he knew all about this operation in the Second World War to go and rescue Martin Bormann. So there are questions about these things, which only only a Truth and Reconciliation Commission will ever really be able to answer.
Yeah, but if we're not going to have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, then police investigations have to go on, don't they?
Well, I think one of the crucial things was when the special branch in Northern Ireland, the old police force's special branch, were closed down, all the records were destroyed. So that certainly cut off a great many of the avenues in relation to an awful large number of the crimes.
What a horrible can of worms. A bit like this chap I was talking about who was working as a security guard at UBS, which we'll be interviewing after I get back. When he went into the boiler room, he found a whole load of records of Jewish victims of the Nazis, the money that they deposited at UBS 70 years after the end of the Second World War, all ready to be shredded, and he managed to rescue them. And there was a hundreds of millions of pound court case against UBS to get that money back for those families. So, you know, there's quite a lot in trying to shred knowledge and shred information around. Anyway, one of the things Theresa May mentioned there was, or it wasn't Theresa May, was it? It was Sir Julian Brazier. Was this £1 million paid off to some terrorist, alleged terrorist anyway. His name is apparently either Ronald Fiddler or Alexandra Coty, depending on what you mean, but it's dominated the news all week. A British suicide bomber from ISIS has joined other extremists, apparently, on a Gaza aid convoy organised by George Galloway after he returned from Guantanamo Bay. And before his £1 million compensation payout, and he's now this week apparently blown himself up as a suicide bomber for ISIS, Martin.
Well, you say apparently, because as I sent you earlier in the week, the source for this allegation is the site website, Searching Internet for Terrorist Entities, run by a former Mossad agent called Rita Katz.
Now, hang on a minute, because what they actually say is IS claims suicide bombing.
Yes, it's a funny thing about that, because all IS is claiming, when the IRA claimed an attack, they used to contact the newspapers in Dublin and say P. O'Neill, and that P. O'Neill was, you could be sure that it was the provisional IRA that carried out the attack. So, for example, the Birmingham bombs, they admitted they carried out the attack, and P. O'Neill admitted it. Now, what happens with ISIS is that all of their PR seems to be run by Rita Katz. So they don't have their own version of getting their truth out. The ISIS makes an allegation, but it appears, first of all, on Rita Katz's website, which is run by an ex-Mossad officer based just around the corner from the CIA in Langley in Virginia. Now, in other words, there's a real question mark over whether this incident ever occurred, because nobody knows. ISIS apparently claimed it, and then site picked it up and told everybody that this guy did it. But it's quite possible that this guy was an agent working for the British all along, and he's still alive somewhere. We just don't know, do we?
They're actually based in Bethesda, Maryland.
Can I also say that because we know, well, but one of the things that we learned in Northern Ireland is that much of what goes on is not what you think's going on, and that in actual fact what you're being told is happening is not necessarily what's really happening, because somebody behind the scenes is pulling another thing.
I don't know if you've been following this case this week, but I've seen several. I mean, it's the topping bulletins all around the London media, front pages of newspapers, etc. And yet we are being expected to believe that this guy has blown himself up as an ISIS suicide bomber. The evidence they show us is a picture of a puff of smoke on the other side of a hill. You don't even see the guy.
The source for this story is highly suspect. Well, Martin spelt it out, but normal newspaper, you don't run a story on the basis of, as you say, a puff of smoke behind a hill.
And the source is ISIS, apparently. Yeah, I mean, ISIS are ISIS.
There's a pattern here. ISIS seem to use Rita Katz as their PR person. She is the one that automatic. And I think people need to look very carefully at this. Because, of course, the suspicion of the Iranian general staff, the Russian general staff, and the Syrian general staff is that ISIS is in fact being run by the Western intelligence services in collusion with the Saudis. Now, people have got to realise that when something like this happens, A, you don't know whether it happened at all. B, if it did happen, you can't be sure what actually happened. And C, that the various cast of characters, including ISIS, maybe not what they appear in any case. And of course, when we're talking, I'll come back to the point about Northern Ireland earlier. Northern Ireland, we know, because of the intimacy with it, that all sorts of things that went on were not what they seemed. And I can assure you that in that case, it must be the case in places like Iraq and Syria, where there are no journalists on the ground to speak of who've got any kind of access, that quite likely we're being fed a load of lies by everybody.
Okay. Also, the Daily Mail reports that this chap, Ronald Fiddler, I suppose is the easiest way to call him, was part of a team of British executioners led by Londoner Mohammed Emwazi, otherwise known as Jihadi John, and was also responsible for the killing of American journalist James Foley and Stephen Sotloff and USAID worker Paul Kassig. So he's part of a team of executioners, Martin.
Supposedly. Now, I would suggest to you, is it possible that these people could be like Steak Knife or like other elements working within the UDA and the UVF? In actual fact, they're possibly British agents. And they go to Guantanamo Bay, but they get released. Why would they be released? Because they've possibly been turned. And it may be that the guy isn't dead. Maybe he's dead already. You've got to ask yourself these questions, because intelligence services are engaged in promoting a narrative of terrorism.
Now, he's also apparently part of the ISIS Beatles. So this is Penny Lane and... What was the other one? I can't remember now.
The other one is...
Strawberry Fields.
Strawberry Fields.
So just take us through that. What is an ISIS Beatle?
Well, they used to refer to people in Guantanamo Bay as being either Penny Lane... Or Strawberry Fields. Now, Strawberry Fields are forever, so in other words, those people are never released. Penny Lane is, if you cooperate with us, we're going to release you.
We're going to send you down Penny Lane.
Yeah, so in actual fact, a lot of, surprisingly enough, a lot of the leaders of ISIS have actually been, the ones we're told about, have actually been in the custody of Western intelligence services, and then they reappear running ISIS. If anybody who knows anything about what went on in Northern Ireland will know that that's pretty obvious what might be happening there. That they are, in fact, agents of the West. And al-Baghdadi, for example, who's supposedly the head of ISIS, we've got a photograph of him meeting with John McCain when he visited Syria a couple of years ago. And as I said, the Iranian general staff, the Russian general staff, and the Syrian general staff are pretty much convinced that ISIS is almost entirely a front organisation for NATO intelligence services and the Saudis.
Now, one of the people we spoke to last week, or we heard from last week, is the US whistleblower Scott Bennett. He's a former US Army CENTCOM psychological warfare officer.
The mainstream media, of course, are CIA dominated. It is and I saw this when I worked in the various circles. CIA, the Mossad, and MI6, and Saudi intelligence have a stranglehold on the American communications, on the American channels, on TV, on the newspapers. So they're dominated by the ideology, and they're also crippled by a retardation in the moral characters of the people who work as journalists and editors. They really just follow a script. There's a laziness. There's no integrity. There's no national service. There is simply worker ants in some sort of nest mentality. And I think that's what sets the alternative media apart, is when we investigate and speak and present ourselves, it's out of a sense of loyalty, love for our fellow human beings, love for our country or what it used to be, and trying to resurrect and regain it from this international globalist village attitude. So the CIA, Mossad, the British MI6, FBI, they all have their tentacles in the American information systems, and I would include the British as well.
Scott blew the whistle in his report Shell Game about the funding of ISIS and jihadi terror groups through UBS Bank in Switzerland. One of the people he met when he was jailed under false pretenses was a chap called Brad Birkenfeld. Now, Birkenfeld had actually been running as a manager for these Swiss bank accounts to secrete money into Swiss banks. But it does seem, and Kevin, maybe you can help us out with this, that this Switzerland is simply the biggest tax haven on the planet, and never mind about Britain or Panama being a tax haven. Switzerland is always going to be there because people can put their money into Switzerland and no one will ever know what they've got. Anyway, this is a clip from a documentary with Brad Birkenfeld done by CBS in the States, mainstream 60 Minutes program. I think it's called A Crack in the Swiss Vault. And it's Brad Birkenfeld is interviewed here. So there's a little clip from that.
He offered to wear a wire to gather evidence against high-level UBS executives in exchange for full immunity for his transgressions. but the negotiations broke down. And Birkenfeld neglected to tell them about his dealings with this man, California real estate developer Igor Alenikoff, who was his biggest client. Birkenfeld helped Alenikoff hide $200 million by introducing him to a consultant who specialized in creating shell companies and sham entities that concealed the ownership of the UBS accounts.
I don't sign people's tax return, so what they do with their taxes is not my business. I'm a banker.
So you would steer them to somebody who would help them hide their money?
You would recommend them to these service providers, that's correct.
You must have known deep down that it was illegal.
When you came into the U.S., you felt uncomfortable. That's correct.
But as a gesture of goodwill, Birkenfeld did give the Justice Department, Senate investigators, IRS agents, and the SEC lots of information about UBS and its secret activities.
Any transaction that happened on an account was held deep in the vault and sealed until the client came to pick it up personally. Then they would either take it with them, which was generally not the case, or they would tell you to shred it, which we would do on behalf of the client.
People didn't have online accounts.
It was forbidden. E-banking was forbidden for U.S. clients.
They didn't get statements in the mail?
No.
So if somebody wanted to know how much money they had in the bank and how their investments were doing, they had to go to Switzerland?
Or maybe see their banker when they came to the U.S.
It was those visits to the U.S. which Birkenfeld told the government about that ultimately got UBS in so much trouble. The bank would sponsor lavish events like yacht races in Newport and the Art Basel Modern Art Festival in Miami Beach to attract wealthy Americans. Then it flew in its bankers from Switzerland to mingle and to try and drum up new clients and conduct business with existing ones. Because the Swiss bankers weren't licensed to conduct business in the United States, it was a clear violation of American banking laws on U.S. soil, and Birkenfeld provided internal documents that proved the length that UBS would go to in order to avoid detection.
Call it a vacation rather than a business trip. Rather than saying, oh yes, I'm coming to see my private clients here in the United States, and I'm coming in from Zurich, Switzerland.
Did you bring records into the country with you when you came in?
Generally, no, I did not. My colleagues brought in encrypted laptops.
Encrypted laptops?
Yes, so that even if they were discovered, you couldn't see what was inside the computers, which were portfolios of the clients, and they were product offerings for the client.
Quite amazing. So if you've got an account at one of these Swiss banks, you can't get a statement. You can't phone them up and say how much is in my account. But you can ask them to send somebody over to sit with you in a cafe with an encrypted laptop to show you what your balance is. And then if the police come in, then they switch the laptop screen off and the police can't get at the information. It does seem that just to connect back to what Scott Bennett was saying, he was saying that these kinds of accounts are being used to fund ISIS, and that's what he found, and for that reason he was jailed, effectively, for nearly a year. And he only made the connection when he was put in the same jail as this guy, Brad Birkenfeld, who'd been running these. Anyway, I'd just like both of your comments on this, because, I mean, it seems pretty simple for the Saudis particularly, and this is what, it was the Saudis and the Kuwaitis mainly who were funding ISIS and Al-Qaeda in the Middle East and these Libyan terror groups, etc. It seems quite simple, a simple procedure. You just make sure the money goes through Switzerland, then no one can trace it, Martin.
Yeah, and of course, when Scott Bennett, in good faith, tells his bosses in US intelligence, oh, yes, they're using UBS to fund themselves, they say, shut up, we know. You know, basically, they know what's going on, and they don't want him to be telling everybody about it.
Well, do you remember the strategy of tension a long time ago, Martin?
Well, in Italy, yeah.
You plant bombs around the place, and you run the propaganda against the other side, or you say it was ISIS or whoever, in order to get, you know, heavy draconian legislation, all this sort of thing. But the United States has a very serious ambition to control the world's banking system, or the bits it doesn't already control. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge disparity between the fines it imposes on banks from other countries in the West and banks in America, which do just as much funding of suspicious entities as any Swiss bank.
Anyway, talking about the Saudis, I was quite amazed to discover that we're off to Bali next week, and so is the King, Saudi King Salman. He's due in Indonesia on another lavish visit, Press TV say. Indonesia has announced that Saudi Arabia's King Salman will visit the country in early March with an entourage of 1,500 people. Well, I imagine some of those might be Muhabarat, or whatever they're called, the Saudi secret police, as reports say the monarch is planning to spend millions staying in resorts and hotels in Bali. Cabinet Secretary Pramono Arungo said on Tuesday Salman would be in Indonesia from March the 1st to March the 9th, leaving almost the same day as we do, adding that the second leg of the trip would see the king relaxing in Bali for 6 days. Officials in Riyadh have yet to confirm the trip and its schedule. However, the ailing monarch, who's now 80, led a 300-strong entourage to Turkey last year. Of course, this is as Salman has acknowledged, Martin, his country is suffering economically due to the global slump in oil prices and the deadly campaign Riyadh has been engaged in for the last 2 years against Yemen.
So, that's information. Are you asking me a question about it?
This is about the Saudis and their how stable do you think the Saudi government is, and what's its kind of prospects?
Obviously, it's very hard to know because it's a very closed society, much more closed than Iran. Much more closed than communist China. But of course, I would suggest that they're in trouble because they're not winning the war in Yemen. They thought they were going to get a quick victory there. They haven't got a quick victory. They're getting bogged down. And they needed to win, and they haven't won. And there's quite a possibility that the Saudi state will collapse, especially if there's an economic or political crisis.
In the background to all of this is the Saudi connection with the 9/11 attacks, which the US has threatened to allow court cases over, and the Saudis have then threatened to pull billions nearly $1 trillion out of the US economy.
Well, Prince Bin Turki, who used to be the head of the Saudi secret services, was appointed as ambassador to the United States some years ago now, and he was asked, well, you were head of the Saudi secret services during the 9/11 attacks, and we've got evidence that you used to know some of the Bin Laden and all the rest of it, and his answer to that was, you'd better ask George W. Bush about that.
Anyway, Kevin, what would you make of the state of Saudi Arabia at the moment? Because it does seem to be under a lot of pressure economically and, of course, trying to wage this war against Yemen, reputationally, I suppose, because it's not really a war, it's a slaughter, and Britain is making £3.3 billion selling arms to the Saudis that they're then using or dropping the ordnance on mostly innocent people in Yemen and using our British-built jets for the purpose.
And bombs. It's very reminiscent of the Iran-Iraq war, where we supplied both sides so that they slaughtered each other with using British weapons, British bombs, shells in particular.
What advice would you have for the Saudi king at the moment?
Abdicate and go and live a hermit's life.
I mean, he would probably say, well, if I abdicate, you're just going to get someone worse take over.
Well, no, you're getting very close. There are tensions within the Saudi upper echelons. There are actually fundamentalists in some of the ministries, including the defence ministry. And I don't mean down the line. The Saudi defence minister is profoundly religious, to use diplomatic language, meaning he's a fundamentalist. And the eastern province is the real vulnerability. It's where all the oil is. It's where the tensions are greatest. And the war in the Yemen is a way of keeping everything out of the way.
Martin, a lot of the history of this goes back to the First World War, the Treaty of Darien, and the Bitter Lake Agreement between Roosevelt and the Saudi King Abdulaziz in 1945.
Yeah, that was after the Second World War, yeah.
Yeah, in 45, yeah. That was, yeah. So we're talking about Bitter Lake and Darien, really, and also the obvious other thing involved in all this was the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which was secret between the two.
Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting that Trump's ban on various countries which supposedly going to bring terrorists into the sacred land of the US, they didn't put the Saudis on the list for obvious reasons, because the Saudis are our closest allies. Britain is probably Saudi Arabia's closest ally, and they're followed closely by the US and Israel. And they're the most they've got 30,000 political prisoners in Saudi Arabia, I believe. quite a lot for a very small country.
And what about the Swiss? Why aren't they on the money laundering list? Surely we should be boycotting all Swiss.
Well, what's happening, coming to pick up on what Kevin was saying earlier, what the US are trying to do, they're trying to make themselves into the tax haven. So Nevada Las Vegas is becoming a tax haven. And it's actually controlled by the Rothschilds. So they're actually, when the Americans accuse other people of laundering money, it's usually because they want the people to come and launder their money with them. And that's what the strategy seems to be.
This goes back to once upon a time, all the Caribbean tax havens were British. And they had British or independent telephone numbers. Nobody noticed some years ago when all the Caribbean islands went on the American telephone system. And this had two purposes. One was to stop our guys spying on Americans, because that's what the United Kingdom was doing. It was using the tax havens in the Caribbean to keep an eye on the American bad guys. So the United States swung its elbow, threw us out, installed the American telephone system, and started keeping records on our bad guys.
Anyway, we're hearing quite a bit tonight about fake news this week about this suicide bomber guy where the evidence is not there, and even if it was there, apparently it's come from ISIS, but this has been leading bulletins right across the country. Also about the Swiss banks laundering money for ISIS being totally secret, and because they're secret, apparently no one knows about it, they're not even listening to whistleblowers. But the result of all this is you do wonder where the fake news is really coming from, and despite all that, last week the Guardian has announced a leak of the government report, which is raising some pretty serious questions about whether our own journalism in this country is going to be safe in the future. The government advisers are accused of a full frontal attack, Kevin, on whistleblowers.
Yeah, I mean, how about the idea of symmetrical lies? That's what we're being faced with, and irrespective of what you think of Russia. You know, at the moment, the Western media are accusing Russia of, you know, hacking everybody and everything. They never mention that we do the same to the Russians. You know, it's in the Western media, in the British press, Russia is the enemy, which was the U.S. administration position. The U.S. wanted to increase tensions with Russia for years to sell more American weapons to NATO. And that's by and large, that's happened. NATO's armies have been moved up to the Russian border. This is called a friendly gesture. But the key thing is symmetrical lying. Our media are absolutely lying to us. They're telling us the Russians are hacking us. The people who are hacking 67% of internet users in the United Kingdom are the National Security Agency. And that is not a conspiracy theory. That is the judgment of a high court.
When? Just reference that, please.
Sorry?
When did the high court say that?
On the 18th of June 2014, the Irish High Court, in a finding of fact, described the activities of the National Security Agency in Europe as, and I quote precisely, mass indiscriminate surveillance. Mass indiscriminate surveillance is criminal in the United Kingdom and unlawful. And that was the judgment. That court's judgment went to the highest court in Europe, was examined in detail and endorsed. And in fact, the European Court of Justice went even further and stopped, at least legally stopped, all legal transfers of data to the United States because of the spying.
So it's about time we revamped the Official Secrets Act, clamped down on journalists and whistleblowers.
I was hoping you'd raise that. This is really important. The consultation document arrived, you know, with lies. The Law Commission said The Guardian had been consulted, Privacy International had been consulted, and Liberty had been consulted. None had. A quick phone call, that's not a consultation. So the Law Commission's idea of reforming the Official Secrets Act started with lies. Then the QC on the Law Commission, who's being paid, £1,000 an hour? some of them are. He then proceeded to carefully go through all the things in, you know, that should be done. He forgot to mention that the Official Secrets Act is violated every day by the United States National Security Agency. He overlooked. If you're going to have a new Official Secrets Act, surely you should look at the old one and say, did it work? And the short answer was, no, it didn't work. When the United States, you know, stole data, interfered with children's emails, the Official Secrets Act was never invoked by anybody. And well, this is not mentioned in 325 pages of Law Commission advice.
That was one of the most shocking front pages I've seen. It's the first time I've actually picked up The Guardian for a long time, and it was a brilliant article, I have to say, which is rare these days. Really important.
But it didn't go far enough at all. The 325 pages and no mention of the most monumental failure in modern history of the previous Official Secrets Act.
Now, one of the ways you can protect yourself against some sort of a cyber attack, we'll have a little look at that now. I've been talking about it on and off for the last few weeks, is my little acronym PREFABS. Maybe you can just chip in, Kevin. Maybe you too, Martin, if you want to, on these various letters. The first letter is P. That is for passwords. I'm suggesting what you do is you use complex passwords, all of them. Choose around about 10. Use the first 3, 4, or 5 for your more important accounts. That is to say, ones like internet banking, say, for example, PayPal, this sort of thing. Anything where, you know, it is actually going to make a real difference if someone hacks that password, takes it away from you. And then use the others for the less important. So you may have one which you use for lots and lots of different accounts which you don't consider so important. And just make sure that you've got around about 10 in total. Change them now. Right, it's quite a good time to change them because we've been given all these warnings about cyber attacks from Russia, which have started, to my knowledge, last June with the Bilderberg conference, and then when were rolled out through the US election campaign. Jens Stoltenberg from NATO said there's going to be a terrible cyber attack, blah, blah. Now, this could all be fear-mongering, but now is quite a good time to do it. Also, when you keep lists of your passwords, write them down. Don't photocopy them because photocopiers can be used to scan for information, and that could, you might find that you're compromising your passwords by allowing a photocopier by just photocopying it. Also, if you have an internet service provider, an ISP, specific ISP, ask them to send you or even go and pick up 10 passwords. Triodos Bank do this. They give you little passphrases and you say, I'm going to use the next passphrase, please, over the phone. So you're not compromising your password by talking about it over the phone. You're just saying it's password number 4 now, please. And you can do this with your internet service provider if they're a good internet service provider. If they don't do it, you might consider switching to one that does. So that's another thing you can do with passwords. Anything more to say on passwords, Kevin?
No, that is a sensible suggestion. You know, keep the vital ones radically different and keep them to what you think is serious.
Okay,
that's a good suggestion.
Now, real privacy, that's R in prefabs. You can use GNU PG, GNU PG, or PGP, which is a very high level of encryption. This was a program put together by PGP was by Phil Zimmerman years ago, and he was actually prosecuted because having secret information sent over the internet, the US Pentagon said that could be a weapon of war, but he won his case, and so it's well worth using that. If you'd like to send messages to people which are encrypted, you have a passphrase, it generates what's called a key pair. So you send the key to someone, they use your key to encrypt your message, and then you can email it to someone, and then they can decrypt it at the other end. The other quite useful thing about these real privacy programs, GNU PG or PGP, is you can actually use them to wipe disks. So if there's a disk you've got which you don't, there's information on there you don't want anyone else to get their hands on, you can properly wipe the disk. So the information can never be recovered from it if it gets into the hand of someone whose job it is to recover information from disks. So that's R. On to E, email accounts. I would suggest pay for one, at least, email account. Don't just use free email accounts, and get one which has got phone support, so you can pick up the phone and speak to somebody on the other end who's going to help you, rather than just have some kind of horrendous online messaging thing where people don't even necessarily speak the same language as you when you're trying to get support. So phone support, even, you know, sort of normal office hours phone support, is quite adequate. Also, have a free email account, maybe a Yahoo account or something, for your junk mail, so you can use that anytime you're having to register for something which you know is going to send you a load of junk mail. Use a free email account for that. That's quite a good thing to do. Okay, so that's E for emails. Now F for your firewall. Now, there are plenty of firewalls out there, but at least it creates a bit of a wall to make it difficult for anyone on the outside to get into your life on your computer and your private information. One of them is called Outpost Firewall, Agnetum Outpost Firewall. I'm not sure if that's still available. That's one that I've used, which was built in St. Petersburg about 10, 15 years ago, and it still seems to work very well. But what it does is it says to you, your computer is trying to do this. Is this you? Do you want it to do it or not? And so you can decide what connections you're making with the outside world and what you're not. Okay, so that's F for firewall. A for air gaps, off internet computer. Have a computer which is not connected to the internet. In fact, maybe never connected to the internet since the day you bought it.
If you have an issue, you know, a real serious privacy or security issue, that is extremely important thing to do. Like, one of the ways of cutting off the bad guys is to unplug your machine. The one thing they can't do is get into a machine that's got no plug in it.
Well, they might be able to do that through the processor. Apparently, sometimes the only way to really keep your data safe is to keep it in some kind of Faraday cage. Mm. In fact, that's what intellectual property people now do. If you've got a patent of some sort, the only way you can keep it, apparently, is inside a cage. But certainly, keeping your computers off the internet is one good way to at least help guarantee and make it difficult for the bad guys, as you call them, to get into your world. Smart devices are not smart, folks. Smart this, smart that. It's just no load of rubbish. Smartphones particularly, there's no proper protection for information that's on a smartphone. There are various apps that I've had on mine which I've had to deinstall because it's just blocking my ability to make phone calls to people. These things are wide open, so don't keep any kind of important information on your so-called smartphone. And also A, that's air gaps. B is for backups. Buy a 3 terabyte drive for about £90, put everything on it. And in fact, what you can do is just use one folder. So copy all the files into a single folder. Then you can see you haven't got loads of duplicates, loads of directories, and you can find stuff if you need to in the future. So make sure you do your backups, folks, before the NSA, Vladimir Putin attacks your computer. That's B for backups. And S for software. Consider using Linux, that is open source software, Red Hat, or one of these other things, which also you can have what is called a Windows emulator on it, so you can run Windows on it, but Windows itself is running on top of Linux, or an old version of Windows, which tend to be a lot better than this appalling thing, Windows 8 and Windows 10, which try to update themselves. It doesn't actually feel like it's your computer anymore. Windows has taken over. You try and start your computer up, as I've had to do for Skype TV interviews, and the computer says, no, I'm not starting. I'm going to do a load of updates now, and it takes half an hour for the computer to actually start. So it's not you're not in control of that computer, so don't use Windows 8 or Windows 10, maybe Windows 7, but certainly the best if you can is to use one of these open source things, and don't upgrade. You can use all sorts of old versions at oldversion.com. So that's it. Prefabs, PREFABS. Kevin, that's any good last words?
The other thing you could do is don't use a internet supplier which has a criminal indictment for stealing data and intercepting emails.
Isn't that all of them?
Microsoft is one of them. Apple's another. Facebook.
It's not easy, is it, to navigate this world?
If the Western media had explained the two court judgments to their readers, they would be a very different situation, I think.
Anyway, it's time to hear about secret societies now from Jakub Zaki. Sorry we won't be able to hear all of this, but I will make sure it's on the podcast uploaded later tonight, the whole of it, because he was absolutely fascinating. Walking into the bus stop, he opened up as a whole new individual to me. Jakub Zaki.
secret societies and subversive movements, Ernesta Webster. The curious thing that most of the books on this subject are written by women. The other one by Miss Stoddart, obviously Scottish, and she did two books on the subject under a pseudonym. They're all about the Masonic connection with revolution.
With the French Revolution, for example, what are the Masonic connections with that?
Many of these societies or clubs, like the Jacobins, in which the conspiracy was hatched, were in fact Masonic. But the whole thing begins in Germany with the Enlightenment and Moses Mendelssohn, and then it was transferred to France, oddly enough, the channel by which these conspiratorial notions for the overthrow of monarchy and its substitution of a republican form of government, many of them were aristocratic. And this, of course, we can see the influence of Rousseau and of Voltaire, but particularly Rousseau, because he was the idol of the 18th century aristocracy.
So what has this all got to do with the Enlightenment?
Well, the Enlightenment is a movement that is still going on. I mean, all the political parties in Britain and on the continent are derivatives of the Enlightenment. They believe in meliorism, that mankind is advancing toward a better future. And so that explains the background to the American Revolution, which influenced the French Revolution, because the American Constitution is the ultimate Enlightenment document. Sovereignty resides in the people.
And does it?
I don't think so. No Muslim would believe that. According to Islam, sovereignty is a prerogative of God.
What's wrong with monarchy?
Well,
to these people.
Yeah, well, according to them, it's much easier for them to take over a state that is non-monarchical in structure. They are secret societies who operate behind screens. And this is what makes them dangerous.
Is there any these sorts of societies in places like China?
Well, the East is the home of secret societies. We must remember the triads are probably the greatest secret society in the history of the world.
How long do they go back?
The triads go back to the time of the Ming. They were overthrown by the Manchus, and the Ming supporters congregated in the south of China in the Canton region and proceeded to intrigue against the new rulers, the Manchus. But, of course, you have not only them, but the Yakuza in Japan, who are possibly the most dangerous of all. But by contrast, they are ultra-monarchical.
Well, what years are we talking about?
Well, the Ming dynasty collapsed at the beginning of the 18th century. So the Triads are very deeply rooted. They have at least two centuries of history.
They're also quite similar to the start of the Illuminati.
Yes. I don't think there is any connection between them, but I would say that there is a connection between the Illuminati and the cult of the Assassins in the Middle East. And the vehicle by which the concept secret society reached Europe was in fact the Crusades, specifically the Templar Order, which was a secret society par excellence. And as you know, they founded the international banking system. They invented the traveller's check.
And how does that link with the Assassins, though?
The Assassins were an extreme group of Ismailis. Ismailis are the seveners as opposed to the twelvers. Orthodox Shia believe in a succession of 12 imams after the death of Muhammad. But for the Ismailis, this stops with the seventh imam, Ismail. And they themselves divided and subdivided and redivided into a multiplicity of sects, one of which is the Assassins. And you know there is the famous film about it, starring that famous Israeli actress, Angels and Demons. You've possibly read the book.
Is there any relevance for today with all this?
Well, I think there is, yes, definitely. In fact, they have penetrated the Catholic Church itself in its inner councils. P2 and the strange hanging of that man under London Bridge. And, of course, who's behind the British government? I would think it's some possibly not just secret but satanic organisation.
So have you got any evidence for that?
The only thing I can think of at the moment is what two of my students said to me. Michael Bentine claimed, not in my presence, but to two of my students, that his son was murdered by the Wilson gang who sabotaged the plane in which he was flying. And the reason was that he had found out the address of the coven in Switzerland, and they were practicing Crowleyan magic, which is not traditional magic. Remember, Crowleyan magic is performed in the nude and therefore is linked to sex, which traditional magic, of course, is not. It sounds very sinister.
It sounds a bit outlandish. Is this really still going on in the world today?
What else can you explain these recent events, like the wars in the Middle East? I believe all this began with the Boer War at the beginning of the 20th century, and the same people who are behind that war, that is the international finance, the banksters and the financiers, are behind all the subsequent wars, and they themselves are linked to secret organisations, like the Bushes, for instance, were in the Skull and Bone Society.
That's Jakub Zaki, that little chat at Bristol Bus Station. Kevin, what do you make of this?
The richest and one of the largest secret societies on Earth, which issues its own passports and all sorts of things, are the Knights of Malta. And at six of the last CIA directors have been Knights of Malta. I wonder why.
So what about connections with other secret societies? Are they the sort of... Because I think, am I right in saying the Templars and the Hospitallers ended up as the Knights of Malta?
The Knights of Malta are the heirs to the Knights Templars and to their fortune. They have no accounts, but you will have noticed that Pope Francis has recently sacked the head.
Interesting, right, who's really in charge? Anyway,
he's trying
anyway,
to be.
Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7, coming up Arabian Nights. Thanks to our guest Jeff Gollop in the first hour. Our sister show Dialects here at BCFM at noon every Tuesday with David Lowe taking us through March. Our show page for your comments is thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Binny Quain's art show tomorrow 10 till 12, and Danny Lopsch Sunday evening at 8, or 7 till 8. Do please join us for Steve Satan's politics show at the same time next week. I'll be back in April, inshallah. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.